comes out and then it hits you with pain. Things are great on the way out, nobody's with you when you're on the way down. You got what you wish for, is that what you Welcome back to the Gods to Ghosts Volleyball Podcast and your host Scott Bemke for part three in the conclusion of our interview with 12-time Beach Open winner, including the 1974 Manhattan Beach Open champion, in 2008 California Beach Volleyball Association Hall of Fame inductee Tom Shimalis. Enjoy the conclusion.
Your hitting, Tom, is legendary. Aside from Henry Bergman, whenever you ask someone who the greatest hitters were in the history of the game on the beach, your name and Henry's come up more often than not, along with a couple others, but more often it's Shimalis and Bergman and a horse apiece. Those who witnessed it and competed against you claim that no one could stop traffic on the beach the way you two guys did. So, first off, you talked earlier about the bomb that you had at the Outrigger Canoe in Hawaii, but were there one or two that you had throughout your career that you can remember that you're just like, wow, I hit the shit out of that, and you think back on it and good memories?
Yeah, I was talking to Kathleen about that, and I remember really kind of two magical moments for me in beach volleyball, and they really were magical. And I think any athlete can, relate to this, that maybe whether it's a basketball player, something magical happens, like you kind of said, geez, that kind of defied the universe. The first one was in San Diego, and we were in a tournament. I can't remember who I was even playing with, but I got to a ball that nobody would have even been able to get to the ball, and I made a perfect hand set. And I just remembered to myself, that was impossible. How did I do that? And then another magical moment, which is really related to the hitting question, I was at Sereno. Unfortunately, it wasn't in the tournament, but it was at practice. And I hit this ball so hard that I really felt like I really felt the earth shaking afterwards. I really felt it. It was this magical thing where, you're just connected with the universe at that moment, and I just literally, I've been in any of the earthquakes in LA or felt the aftershocks, but that earth was literally vibrating, under me after that particular spike. I did one other hit that I did bounce a ball at Sereno, and I know a lot of guys that play there recreationally remember seeing it, but it did go into the Hilton House, and I believe it was on one bounce. I don't think it could have made it two bounces, because I think the second bounce would have been too low. But that, if you're obviously, I'm facing south in A court, and I hit a ball that bounced over into the old Hilton House, which is there. So those were really. And that 76 World Championship where the lightning was happening at Jose Cuervo Gold, I mean, I was really exploding on some balls there. So those were kind of really stand out to me, and as I said, those two magical moments, even one was a stunning thing. I just think every athlete, Russell Westbrook, doing something sensational again. After all those games, maybe there's a couple of things that go, oh my gosh, I did that something, So I think any athlete might be able to relate to, some kind of magical moment, and those two kind of really stand out to me.
How'd you get? What happened when that ball went over the wall into the Hilton's backyard? What'd you do?
Yeah, that was the strangest thing, because I hopped the fence and got the ball. You and I were talking about this story, and then I go, oh, are you Mr. Hilton? He goes, my name's John Monroe. And I go, my name is Tom Chmalis. And the guy almost fell in the pool. And it turned out he was a very close friend of my father, who was an author, and my father actually had him in his book and nicknamed him the Pope. So if I want to talk about a small world, you know, you know, the idea that, you know, and I actually went and visited with John for a couple of days after that. He was doing some work for Mr. Hilton at the time. The house was abandoned. Mr. Hilton let him stay there, you know. His name was John Monroe. So that was kind of a small world thing. But, yeah, I mean, very fortunate on that.
What about the outrigger? I've never been there. I've seen the photos and heard a lot about it, but what were the dimensions, or how far away was that, or how high was that wall when you blasted two of them?
Well, it was a fence. It was a chain link fence, and you know, so much of the balls with the height too, it's where you just kind of hit the angle of the sand, right?
Right. If there's the right divot, you know, or what have you.
Yeah. Yeah, you're lucky enough to hit that angle where it pops and gets the height, but it was just kind of unique because I don't know how long they've had those. I think a long time, because Outrigger always had a good indoor team that they would bring to the Nationals. So those guys had to, you know, obviously they had beach volleyball courts at the Outrigger Canoe Club. In fact, they had the bay court there where all the guys are like 6, 8, 10 years old would play. You know, smaller net, smaller court, and then they would graduate up. But I just remember the first time playing there and doing that. And then, you know, of course, Tommy Hain, you know, says you're a guest member. He was president of the club. You're a guest membership. And then, you know, every time we played, we won. And he called, you know, he called me his credit card. He would charge a win or something. But, yeah, that, you know, those guys were just, you know, why is such a beautiful spot? And to be playing volleyball. There was the only other course that I remember there was Fort DeRussy, and they weren't sand courts. They were actually, you played on the cement at Fort DeRussy, which was up by the Waikiki Hilton, you know, the Hilton up there somewhere. But I just love, you know, going there and playing. I'd play, you know, and that was the thing. I'd play with anyone. You know, anybody that asked me, I'd play with them. You know, I never looked down if you weren't very good or you were great or anything like that. I always played. I always just wanted to get out there and play.
Now, we talked about your hitting prowess. Let's talk about some of the people you witnessed over your career. Who were the five most impressive hitters you saw, Tom?
Well, I've got to say Henry. You know, Henry Bergman impressed me very much coming up. You know, he arched his back, and he almost looked like he took his elbow and kind of almost got to eye level and just would come down and hit the ball so down, and it would really bounce. And, you know, he was about 6'2", I mean, but he was totally great shape. And Henry definitely impressed me as a hitter. This is not beach related, but one time I went to an indoor match, and I was very young. I must have been 22, 23, 24. And I saw Ernie Sawara hitting balls indoors that I thought, my goodness, I never seen anything like that. Just bombing the heck out of them. I was, you know, obviously I had these questions in advance, and I was trying to think of them. I think when I played in the IBA, Jeff Redden from Santa Barbara on our team really hit a heavy ball. Strong guy, 6'4", could jump, but really hit a hard, heavy ball. And then I picked Pat Power and Randy Stoklas. And that, I would have to say Bergman, number one, and really the other four could kind of go on any order, you know. Sure. Not to put them, but I would certainly start with Henry as number one. And then those players really, you know, Randy Stoklas definitely, you know, hit a young ball. I remember Mark Elber, I forget who, somebody said, that Kent Steffes was like a young TC. I think Moki did. But, so I, you know, and I saw Kent with Karch, and obviously they were a great team, but, you know, he was very athletical. But I mean, those five players to me, and they're a little bit off the, you know, they're not all beach players, but I don't think I really got so impressed by his. I mean, I hate, and I'm not trying to act egotistical.
Right.
It's just that, it's just like, I don't know, but Henry certainly did it. And then these other guys certainly impressed me, for sure.
Von Hagen said the same thing, because you would have been in awe if you would have seen Ernie Sawara hit a ball indoors. I don't know if anyone's ever hit the ball harder. I know he saw Gene Selznick hit the ball like that at the, like, 62 or 65 Nationals, where he was, he had never seen Gene really, like, when he was motivated and saw him play indoors, and he was like, holy smoke, he took it up a notch or two. But Ernie was the other guy, I think, indoors that he saw that he said just, you know, detonated. So he was that good, huh?
Yeah, he was killing it. I remember as we started off the interview, I mentioned I saw Gene Selznick in an indoor thing, the most perfect arm swing. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I believe he was the setter usually indoors, you know.
Right.
So he had really just really impressed me. It's just that we were kind of coming up and those guys were going out, you know. And so I wasn't seeing, and I was kind of seeing Sorrento. It wasn't like I would go to tournaments or unless I was playing with him. But Ernie really, look at Pat Power. I mean, gee, Pat Power really hit that ball down. And I think Stoklas is just, you know, a big, powerful guy. But I think Kathleen, my wife, thinks Randy, I reminded her a little bit of Randy, or Randy reminded a little bit of me in the hitting prowess. And Jeff Redden, I don't think a lot of people know about Jeff, but boy, he could really swat it. And I believe he was UC Santa Barbara, but he was in the IBA in 77.
Got it. Good stuff. On the other end of the spectrum here, who were the five best defenders or diggers that you saw play?
Well, I've had to think about this question. It's amazing because I went with Lang, you know, the first stop. And then I really got lost because for me, Scott, I really didn't dug very often. First of all, I didn't get served very often, but I didn't get dug very often. So it's kind of hard to judge. I mean, I've always, you know, when Jim and I get together, which is maybe once or twice a year, I always say, Jim, if you and I would have played in more tournaments, you know, I just feel like we could have dug everybody off the court. So I know what a good defensive player Jim is. And I know Matt Gage was very good. I heard John Stevenson was an amazing defensive player, you know. I just remember Lang digging balls and, you know, driving that team of him and Von Hagen. So for me, that was the standout. And it's just hard for me to kind of get into the better defensive players. You know, Volleyball Magazine's done some things in the past years, and they've had lists that they put together, and I would probably agree with them in so many. I would imagine Karsh would probably be, you know, such a good all-around player. Well, you know, I'll tell you one player for sure. Cinch, a great defensive player, too.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to see him, and he was the best I ever saw.
Yeah, I remember Dave Hayes were coming back, and I believe they were playing Hermosa, down in Hermosa, or it could have been the Manhattan Open, and he said, I've never seen anything what I saw Sinjin doing. He said, I saw him digging balls with his feet. He said it was just the most incredible thing. And you know, and I remember Matt Gage saying one time, Scott, I was at a tournament, and this was, you know, in probably the 90s, and Matt goes, God, I've never seen anybody see the court like Sinjin, you know, getting those perfect sets from Randy, and then just totally, you know, shooting the ball where nobody's at, you know, that he could just look at the court, find the ball. And that's so hard to do because, you know, most sports you're supposed to be, you know, you watch an NFL player start running before he catches the ball, right? The most important thing is to watch the ball. And so when you, I'll never forget Matt saying that. And, you know, that team was a very good team, you know, but I think people started having a little bit more success against that team is when they started to serve Randy. You know, Sinjin was such a great passer, and Randy was such a great setter that you know. And then of course, Sinjin was very good on the side out and mentally tough. But yeah, I'd have to put going back to the defensive. You'd have to certainly, I think, throw Sinjin in there. But it's just hard for me all the other players, you know.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned Lang, and in one of the interviews that I did with him, which I haven't posted yet, I asked him about the three most memorable digs he's had in his career. And one of them that he listed was when he and Ronnie were playing against you, and I'm guessing it must have been Mengus. And he goes, Tommy just had one of his, he just crushed it. And normally he'll just say someone hit a ball or what have you. You know, he doesn't throw compliments around too frequent. But he said, Tommy just crushed it. And he goes, I got my knees in the sand, and it was probably one of those that was like within 10 feet of the net, like you crushed. And he said he threw his hands up and he dug it, and Ronnie ran it down and went to go set it, but he mishandled the ball. But he said he'll never forget that one, where even he was a bit surprised that he dug that one, because that probably would have, the earth would have been vibrating had that hit the sand. So, well, from the sounds of it, and you know Lang, getting a compliment from him is like getting a call from Ed McMahon about winning the lottery.
No, he's, and, you know, I heard a little bit of his interviews, and when he starts going into the statistics of your percentage of winning.
Yeah, you know, he had 66%.
That's how he ranked the percentage of winning, you know. I mean, he's got it down to a science, but he... Yeah, you know, and he was a heck of an indoor player, too. You know, those guys, that was quite an era. You know, those guys, you know, the O'Hara, Bright, Selznick, Keith Erickson, State Beach, Manny Sines. I heard Manny Sines was Tris. Bernie Holtzman, his son Dane becoming, I was with Ron, and Dane shows up and doesn't show up at the tournament, became Hare Krishna.
Oh, gosh. Fred's story about that is priceless. I could listen to that over and over.
It is. I mean, you know, for you to be doing this, Scott, it's just so fabulous. It's going to be out there for people to see and hear in the future, because, you know, you see these old skateboarders, you see these old surfers or all that, and the Southern California thing, and of course, all the other eras after us, you know, and our eras before us. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I love doing it. I always looked forward to... in the 80s getting volleyball monthly when I learned the sport in 88, and that was all I had to, other than when I'd tape it on VHS when it would be on, you know, ESPN hot Tuesday nights and stuff. So you know, now being able to talk to you guys like this, it's like a dream come true, and kind of my Manhattan Beach Open. So if I talk with marbles in my mouth, you'll have to understand where I'm coming from here. So
love a sport like that. Yes.
Yeah, you guys were, you know, just like it says, I mean, you guys were absolutely gods, and I wish and hope somebody does a really good documentary on you all. Like, if you've seen the movie, the surf movie Riding Giants at all?
I don't think I have.
Okay, I think they do a really good job about the sport, and, you know, they talk to, you know, how it got its start, and they talk to a lot of the great figures in it, including the historical ones like Greg Knoll, and, you know, you just get a really good feeling and vibe from it, and that even if you weren't a surfing fan, like after watching it, you'd be like, I'm a fan now, and I'm a fan of those guys. And someone needs to do something like that for you guys. And at the end of that, they kind of interview Greg Knoll, and, you know, he's the one that rode Waimea and those huge waves. Yeah, and, you know,
he had those black and white striped trunks.
Yeah, like a prisoner, right?
Like a prisoner, like a represent thick black and white trunks, the bull. Oh, he was...
They're like a brick shithouse, and they've got, like, that classic picture of him, like, standing at Pipeline holding that, and he's kind of built like you, you know, like, yeah, the bull. And there's a part at the end of that, if you get a chance, watch that with your wife sometime. And at the very end, they kind of like do some outtakes, and they're talking to him, and he's starting to get a little bit emotional. And he says, you know, every now and then I make it back to Hawaii, and I go up to Waimea, and I take a look at her, and, you know, I see that the sun glistening off the face of that wave, and that sparkle, and she winks at me, and she says, hey, Greg Knoll, I remember you. And he says, I'm not a real emotional guy. But he gets pretty like, it's a real heavy moment, and that, I just think it'd be cool if people could do something like that with guys like you and Von Hagen and Lin Lang and the Gages and Swartzes and stuff. So this is, you know, the best is I can do being the amateur tool I am here from Milwaukee, but hopefully somebody gets an inkling from this and does it, because you guys certainly deserve it, and people need to know about, you know, everything you've done for the sport, you know, and pave the way for.
Yeah, I mean, and those guys are so brave, right? The surfers, especially riding those big waves.
Yeah,
right, they have, and of course now, yeah, it's. I think people now really like to look back in all the sports. You know, the beginnings of the NBA. I remember seeing the old NFL footage, and those guys were so close that, and they'd hardly made any money, that they would go over to their teammates' house and help, you know, build the cabinets in the new house and barbecues and,
right.
And, you know, all the surfers, you know, one of the great quotes by Gene Selznick was, he goes, well, yeah, you know, when I played volleyball, they called us a bunch of beach bums. And now volleyball players are called the professionals, volleyball professionals, you know, and so I think everybody kind of likes to see those roots and those beginnings in all the sports, and especially, you know, we're so fortunate because it was this, even though you're in Wisconsin, it was this Southern California sport. And the great thing about beach volleyball, when you think about it too, Scott, you can put, you know, think of all the beautiful beaches in the world, and it's the true beach sport. I mean, you can throw the frisbee, and you can throw the football on the beach, and you can play over the line. You have all your water sports on the beach, you know, surfing, body surfing, etc. But beach volleyball is the true sport on the beach, and it's so unique that way.
Yeah, it sure hooked me when I first was exposed to it in '88, and I can only imagine what it would have been like being at Sereno. You played against a lot of great teams over your career. Who were the three best you ever competed against or saw?
Well, I'd have to go Lang and Von Hagen. Just coming up and trying to beat them and being competitive against them. I think Rundle and Bergman, when Ron and I played them at
Santa Barbara.
Yeah. And, you know, as far as Ron and I, you know, Jim and Greg were a very, very good team. But there were so many good teams, you know, out there that, I mean, look at, you got your, as far as me competing against, I'd have to say, yeah, I would definitely go probably Lang and Von Hagen, and then just, even though I didn't play Rundle and Bergman that much, maybe twice, but they were such an outstanding team. And then of course Jim and Greg were just such a good ball control team, a great side out team, and you know, obviously lost so many times with Ron to them. But that's a tough one. I mean, if you were gonna, because I didn't see, you know, I guess Selznick could play with anybody, you know, and I know Brighton O'Hara was such a tough team, and all those past guys, and of course your teams in Sinjin and Randy and Karch and Kent, and of course Phil now, and of course with Todd Rogers. But it's, I would probably say those three teams.
Okay.
But it was, yeah, but it always kind of goes back for myself. It wasn't like I looked at a team and got intimidated by them or thought of them as such a great team. It was more about, okay, a plane, not really, I guess, thinking of the consequences or anything, and then, oh, yeah, they're a great team or something, you know?
But right.
They're kind of naive. Probably not being too right.
Well, it served you well, I think, rather than being intimidated by people, right?
Yes, right.
As Bob Seger once said, I wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. In 75, you left the beach after you were player of the year in 74, obviously, with winning with, four different partners and you took the 5K and went and played indoors in the IVA, and you touched on that experience already, but is there anything else about that time that you wanted to go over and cover with us, or things important to share about that league and your time in it?
Yeah, El Paso, you know, and what was interesting about that first year of the IBA, you know, Wilt helped the IBA. And I got to know Wilt fairly well. And he was a nice guy. I partied once with him in Hawaii. And remember going to a Laker game and down on the courts. And, hey, Tom, how you doing? He's warming up. I got kind of mad at Wilt because Wilt always had to have so much to appear. Because he brought so many people. Wilt Chambers was playing volleyball. You know, I thought, geez, my niece, Wilt's made a fortune in basketball, you know. And here's he has a chance to get back to a sport. And at least with the IBA, it was always money and that type of thing. And so I would get kind of mad at him. But we had this thing, I can't remember what year it was. Nike did a Legends of Beach Volleyball at UCLA, and they brought the scene in on the tennis courts, and they had four women, and they had doubles men and doubles women. And Gabrielle Reese, I think, played the four women thing. And anyway, it was kind of weird because when you walked in, and I was one of the legends, but when you walked in, everybody had a picture, and then where I didn't even have a picture of myself.
Stick figure.
Yeah. So there's like seven legends of beach volleyball. Everybody's got their picture, says their name, tells a little bit. So gets to mine where my picture's supposed to be is blank, unavailable.
Classic.
So that was kind of odd, but I'll never forget, I've never been able to figure this out. So Wilt was there. They honored Wilt. Nike did as well. The legend of beach volleyball. So we were walking afterwards. There was about eight of us, you know, four or five legends, their spouses or girlfriends or whatever. And Wilt must have said five times, I wish I was Tom Shimon. I wish I was Tom Shimon. I wish I was Tom Shimon. And I could never to this day figure out why. And I wish I would have asked, had a chance to ask him, because before I knew it, he had passed on. But what was really good is that afterwards, he got on TV and he said, listen, I'm not a legend of beach volleyball. The guys out here you saw today were legends of beach volleyball. Maybe I brought some notoriety and I got to play, but I thought that was so great of Wilt.
Yeah.
He really stepped it up because my initial thoughts, because, you know, the league was trying to make money, even though those guys were all so rich to begin with that owned it, the IBA, but, you know, he had 5,000 or 10,000 to show up, you know. But boy, in the end, he really, I remember he gave that speech and I just respected him tenfold when he had done that. But that's, you know, the IVA was, it was an interesting concept. I think probably, as I said before, maybe that if they would have gone to six men or maybe even six women, who knows, that probably, that league probably would have flown because it was huge in Europe. Second biggest sport in the world was indoor volleyball at that time. At least in 77 when I would go out and soccer being the biggest sport in the world ever.
Right.
And I never really realized, you know, that indoor volleyball was a second big sport in the world, but it was. But anyway, just try to, you know, challenge myself in the IVA, and it was interesting. You know, Dave Shaco, roommate down there in El Paso, and, you know, I just wished in a lot of ways I, you know, would have probably stayed on the beach, but life is the way it is. That's what happened. It was a good experience also.
All right. So coming forward to today's day and age, they changed the rules in the early 2000s to the short court and rally scoring. What are your thoughts on the game and how it's played today?
I think it's wonderful. And to me, it mimics tennis so much. You know, the sets, you win a set, I guess. You win a match. You have the net with the ball. I guess the first serve can be live now. I don't know what the rule is. I think Senjin was responsible, maybe you know this more than me, that as far as shortening the court, coming up with that rule to increase the rallies. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's not a marathon. And, you know, they did that in tennis. They came up with the tie break. And so I think it's a lot of similarities to tennis, and I kind of they say it's harder to come back in the rally scoring, but it seems fairly entertaining. I mean, boy, what a life they have, you know. They have the course rate, have referees on the corners, and, you know, it's a real, you know, I try to watch the Olympics and a little bit of the indoors or some of the beach tournaments, and just those guys. I think what's happened now also, Scott, you have so many more athletes. And, you know, Bob Ramos Boots at Sorrento always said, you know, what was happening to beach volleyball, Jim and Greg and myself and other players coming up in the 70s, you were getting better athletes in the sport. And I think, you know, that played other sports, you know. And I think that's what you really see is just, you know, you're getting guys just, you know, they're all chiseled out, 6'6", can jump and have all the fundamentals. And, you know, it's like, you know, like a golfer, you got these kids that never heard of that hit the ball 300 yards. And
right.
So I think the parity and have it see it grow to such a large sport, to see the venues in the Olympics. And I guess in London you couldn't get a ticket, and that's just fabulous. And you know, they're getting more like a tennis player going around the world playing tennis or golf. Or so and the idea that you could build a court, you know, in New York or somewhere and bring the sand in and actually even not even have it at the beach. So I think the game's it's pretty interesting to watch, and I kind of enjoy it, and I enjoy the athletes that are playing in it. It just probably the matches aren't as long, and I would have liked over the net block. I think that would have been a good deal, but we didn't have that. And shoot, I remember playing the IBA. Nobody was hitting from the 10-foot line, you know, in the IBA. And those were all players from around the world. So that's changed. You need to get the back row now, and you're bombing away. So, yeah, I just think you better athletes, more parity, competition from all around the world. Sponsors are there, and, you know, big in the Olympics, and, you know, all the look at the supposedly women's doubles volleyball, the fastest growing sport ever in the history of NCAA sports, the doubles beat. I hear now the men's are coming in with the doubles, and volleyball is getting all the notoriety it deserves. And, you know, being a basketball player, Scott, I used to think that was the ultimate workout. You know, you play 10-15 minutes of basketball, you're pitting, sweating like a son of a gun. You know what? Go out there in a beach game and move around for 10 minutes. You're sweating. You're sweating just like you are in basketball. What a workout, right? You're reaching, jumping, running, sprinting. You're doing everything, you know. And, you know, watch these guys, you know, do the jump serves. And great athleticism. Really fun to watch.
I'm going to ask you a hypothetical now. In your prime, how would you do against a team like Dalhauser and Rogers playing old school rules, the ones that you played? It was basically big court, side out scoring, no antennas, no blocking over, tight hand setting, Spalding ball, 2 out of 3 to 11. Who would you pick as your partner? And then what would your strategy be against a team like Dalhauser and Rogers?
Well, I think it would almost be the same as when we played, because it would be to side out and to dig some balls, hopefully, and to outlast them. I mean, that's what you're gonna, if you're facing Phil and Todd, they're gonna be siding out against you. And so you better be siding out, and then you're hopefully somebody's gonna get tired. Really what happened in our era is people got tired. And when people got tired, funny things started to happen there. And I think that would be the grind of it. Who's going to be the most physically fit? Who's going to sit out there in a two-hour game to 11, or two-hour game to 11, side out, and, you know, people get tired, and then, the digging. You know, if you can get a dig here and there, and it gets some points. But I really don't. I would have the same strategy. One thing, looking back, I certainly should have worked on a better serve. And the only person that ever jump served in our era was really Vogie, and it was very And it wasn't very often in the tournaments, but he did break it out once in a while. So the serve would be something I would really try to work on facing those guys. Try to make them move. You know, I watched Nick Lucerno and Phil's partner, and he's almost at the back line, you know, on serve reception. So his thought is, I'm coming forward, you know. And but I would think, try to, you know, maybe take some risk with the serve. You know, I mean, it's kind of crummy because the other team doesn't do anything. They get the ball back to serve if you miss your serve. Unfortunately, or however you want to call it. But try to be a tougher serve, but just try to get into the whole thing of grinding out. As far as picking a partner, gosh darn, I mean, there's so many that I could pick, but I would probably pick Karch. Karch was, to me, like, I kind of used the analogy one time of him being like the Michael Jordan of volleyball, you know, that he was so good indoors and so good on the beach. And of course, Michael, you know, even he went and played pro baseball for a while, but I never played with Karch. I remember one time he came down to Sorrento and Chris was down there, Marlo, and he ended up playing with Chris, and I had an opportunity to at least play a practice game. I wish that would have happened. I mean, I think it would be great to play with Gene Selznick. You know, Mark Eller once said, TC and anybody. But I don't know, you know, it's hard to say play with Karch because I've never played with him, but I know what a fine player he is, and you know, he kind of reminds me of Ron and that kind of dedication and side out and just the drive that he had. And but that's a kind of a tough question, you know. I mean, it'd be great to pick Henry Bergman. It'd be great to, you know, there's so many, maybe even Randy Stolquist or something. I don't. It's so hard to pick the player. But I would probably. Looking at the questions and seeing that, I would probably say Karch, but I'd really be a grind, you know, hopefully grind him out, get some digs, and me personally would have worked on my serve and take some risks with the serve and hopefully, you know, have a chance to compete and have a chance to win at the end or sooner the better if that were to happen, you know. But that's about the best way I can answer.
Looking back on your career, Tom, what are you most proud of, and how would you like people to remember you?
Well, I think I'm very proud that I called every call the way that I saw it. So whether it was practice or in a tournament, if that ball was out by an inch, I didn't call that ball in to benefit myself. I called it out, and if I lost that game or that tournament, whether it be practice, then that's, I always felt I did that. I never, ever tried to cheat to win. I made the, and I had an eagle eye. So I really, really would like to be remembered of really always making the right call and being fair on the court, not trying to get an advantage by doing something, you know, making the wrong or doing something to, you know, take advantage of the situation.
And you learned that from Vogue, right?
Well, Vogue was probably the opposite of that. But, you know, I remember playing cards with Wilt, and Wilt would sit there and just cheat you to death. I mean, it was like, why, Wilt? You know,
you weren't even. He'd have a different color deck of cards. Everything. No, we had these at the start.
I was a loose end. Wilt just wanted to cheat. You know, it just didn't make any sense.
Oh my goodness! Sorry for interjecting that. I couldn't resist.
This is funny though. Yeah. The second thing would probably be that. Always to be remembered that I was a part of this big volleyball family. I played my part in it. And for the fantastic fans, for the fantastic players, and to be, have that be a part of my life, was, gosh, I couldn't think of anything nicer than that. And the you know, I lost a nephew, Cameron Black, in his young 30s, so I, just the nicest young man you could ever meet, and my nephew, and, you know, he was a good volley, good, great athlete, he knew everything about everything, and, you know, he said to me, Tom, you know, he played high school volleyball, and he said to me, he goes, Tom, you're the shoeless Joe Jackson of beach volleyball. So, you know, that's coming from Cameron, and, you know, that kind of meant a lot to me. And I think those are probably the three things, you know, that calling it square, those are probably the three things that would be, that I'd like to be a part of the wonderful world, and of course, Cameron's coming.
Beautiful. And what are you up to nowadays? Where are you living? Do you have any hobbies? You married? You have a family? What have you been doing for work? What's the story on TC since his playing days ended?
Well, I live in Santa Monica. I've been in the same rent control apartment since 1978 when I hooked up with my best friend and the love of my life, Kathleen Black. And we've been together now for, I guess, 40 years. And we got a beachfront house north of Rosarita Beach in 1983. And that's when I was still surfing a lot. And which is about, you know, 20 minutes past the San Diego border, which is just fantastic, Scott. You know, I got 50 feet of garden, then the sand, and the Coronado Islands are straight out front. And of course, I don't surf anymore. But there's a golf course 5 minutes away called Real Del Mar, and I've been a member since 93. You know, I'd like to play golf, but it's just, I'm kind of a hack, but I just enjoy it. You know, you three putt from 8 feet, so you're freaked out. I love to fish. I worked 13, when I, after volleyball in 79, I worked 13 years as a teamster on the night shift, and then Kathleen was working night shift at UCLA. We would get off Friday mornings, drive to Rosarita, come back Monday night, you know, be at the beach house. And then in 93, I went to work for my brother selling the toner cartridges, and he sold the company, I believe, about 12, 15 years ago, and I still carried on. And I still do it. Now I'm off-site. I'm an independent contractor. Once in a while, I get an order. I don't really cold call anymore. And we got a house in 93 beachfront about 34 kilometers of San Felipe. That's basically on the other side of the Baja Peninsula that people don't know, and it's desert on the ocean, and just fantastic. You know, it just, in fact, I'm here on, it's just a very unique spot. So those are just, and, you know, Kathleen's family, she has five brothers, and my brother Jerry is, you know, pretty much retired, and I'm in contact with my mother daily. She's 88 now. We probably, you know, speak 10 or 15 times a day. She has some short-term memory loss going on, but it's always just to have her still on the planet and being able to communicate with her. And I do try to get up there and spend a day or, you know, a week at least. But she's getting elderly, and we've got a full-time caregiver with her. But just feeling so blessed to be alive every day, and feel like a very lucky man, you know, to in life, and you know, to be here and be a part of the universe, and the great sport of volleyball was a part of it, and just feel just blessed, Scott, thank God every day.
Oh, that's awesome. This was a really great experience for me to be able to talk to you. I have to give a thank you to Jim Mengus for getting me your phone number. I would have never thought in a million years I'd get a phone number from Jim Mengus, unless it was like, but to get it to someone like you, and then to be able to connect with you, and then have you be such a an awesome guy and have such great stories and share them for 2 hours while you're in beautiful Baja. And here you are on a phone with some chump in Wisconsin at 10:30 at night or whatever it is. But this was an amazing experience, to say the least. And I'm sure all the rest of the crew that you played against and with, and the fans who witnessed you guys, will get a big kick out of listening to this. So thanks, Tom. This was phenomenal.
Well, thank you, Scott. I can't wait to meet you someday, and I'm sure we will. We'll at least have a beer, and I know you know, with what you're doing, you're probably going to have to connect up, get in touch with the AVP, and say, hey, why don't we bring these guys back for a dinner one every other year? I don't know, but I can't wait to meet you, Scott. You're such a gentleman, and I really believe this is so great, what you're doing, because this is historical, and you had the guts and the drive to do it, and I think it's going to just help the sport. When I listen to those interviews, like the other day with Mike Norman, and read his email, I mean, he's so knowledgeable. He remembers all the players. I forget so much, and Matt and Jim and Ron and David Boardwell and of course Fred and what great guys. I mean, these guys are just, you know, I don't really remember any. I mean, I got a little controversial there for a while, but I think all of us really kind of care for all, you know, the volleyball. I think all the sports are. We care for each other, family. Just thank you for what you're doing. And I think it's going to it's going to go down. I think people are going to appreciate it in the future, if not now.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Tom. I appreciate that. And I'll let you get back to enjoying that beautiful Baja, and I look forward to catching up with you down the road.
I can't wait to meet you, Scott. Can't wait to talk to you next time. Thank you so much for doing the interview, and I really appreciate the time to share some stuff with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. You take care. Shoeless Joe.
Adios, amigo. Adios, my amigo.
All right, see ya.
This concludes our 3-part interview with Tom Shamalis. Thanks so much for tuning in for it. If you haven't done so already, please make sure to check out our website, which is godstoghosts.com. And also check out our Facebook page, which is Gods to Ghosts Volleyball, and our YouTube channel, Gods to Ghosts Volleyball. Thanks again for listening. Look forward to sharing more with you soon. Thank you.